One of our favorite restaurants is McAllister's Deli. We've been eating there for years, and we like the menu and the prices and the quality, and it's one of those places that our experience has been that we've been to a lot of different ones, and we kind of know what to expect, and so it kind of meets our criteria. Well, anyway, if you've ever been there, you notice that they wear T-shirts. The employees wear T-shirts, and on the front, there's a logo of McAllister's logo. And on the back of, I think, most of them, maybe all of them, is some little slogan. When we lived in Louisville, there were two McAllisters not far from where we lived, and one of them, every time I went in, it seemed like I saw two slogans consistently. One said, "It's always better to give than to receive," and the other one said, "Genuine hospitality." Now, regarding that first one, I always wanted to know who's giving and who's receiving, because I think I'm the one paying. And I don't even think they ever gave me so much as a free cookie. And if they gave me a free cookie, that was well absorbed in the profit margin from the sandwich, so I never felt like I was really getting much free. So I'm never clear exactly in what sense they were giving me much of anything. I always paid for it. So I always wondered about the wisdom of that T-shirt. And then the second one is a little bit more interesting. The idea of hospitality. Again, if I'm paying for it, how are they being hospitable to me? They have not offered me anything. I mean, they're nice to me, they're friendly to me, they smile at me, especially when I pay. But I don't think it's one of these things where they're just going to invite me to come in and sit and do nothing. Suppose I just went to a McAllister's every day and just walked in at lunchtime and sat down. I think before long, they would say, "Are you going to buy anything?" And if I said, "Well, no, because you're talking about genuine hospitality," they're going to say, "Scram," which doesn't sound very genuine to me. But it shows the idea of how we take an idea and turn it into something it was probably never intended to be. The word hospitality in our culture has really become synonymous with business. As I was working on this lesson, I decided to run an experiment. So I got on Google, and I just typed in the word hospitality, nothing else, just hospitality, and I clicked on the images, Google Images, hospitality. There had to be, you know, probably 100 or more hits on the first page. Every one of them, every hit on the word hospitality in the images, every image I brought up was a picture of either a restaurant or a hotel. There was not a single picture of grandma warmly embracing her guests as they came in for pot roast. Every one of the pictures was about business. At Sullivan University in Louisville, it is the home for the National Center for Hospitality Studies. And when the hospitality studies is a euphemism, it means you can actually get a Bachelor of Science in Hospitality Management. And what that means is, get a degree there, you can run a hotel or you can run a restaurant. That's what hospitality often means in our culture. It's just business. And again, if I'm paying for it, how is it hospitality? And I'm sure they're talking about professionalism and being nice to your customers. But that's a far cry from what the Bible talks about in terms of hospitality. I want us to resume our study of our annual theme, Created in Christ Jesus for Good Works, based on Ephesians 2, verse 10. We've tried every month to incorporate some sermons about this theme. If you'll recall, in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 through 10, Paul reminds us that we are saved by grace through faith. But the consequence of that, he spells out in verse 10 of Ephesians chapter 2, where he says, we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. A consequence of being saved by grace through faith is the idea that God expects us to do certain things. He expects us, as a consequence, to engage in these good works. And so we've been talking about these good works all year. This lesson and then one more in December are the last two that I have planned. And this morning I want to talk about the good work of hospitality. Hospitality, I think, is a really important thing. The Bible teaches about it. It's probably not one of those themes that gets hammered on like some other things. But it shows up periodically in lists of commands to Christians, and we have plenty of examples of it in the Bible. So it tells me it's something that's relatively important in developing our relationship to other Christians. So I want us to spend our time this morning talking about this important good work. Now, the first thing I want to do is go to the text that was read for us just a moment ago in Genesis chapter 18 and talk about Abraham's example of hospitality. The setting here in Genesis chapter 18, this is 1 year before Isaac is born. Now, at this point, if you'll notice, Abraham is called by his full name. So at this point, God has already changed his name from Abram to Abraham. And a number of things have transpired. He has already had his other son, Ishmael, through Hagar. That was Sarah's manipulation. And we see some of the consequences of that at this point. The very next chapter resumes the story of Lot. Lot kind of disappears for a while from the text. He is Abraham's nephew. He's traveled with him all the way from Ur of the Chaldeans and Haran, and he's down now in Palestine. And as we know, Lot decided to move toward the lush ground of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he decided to be very selfish in his choice and very worldly in his choice. And we're about to see in chapter 19 some of the consequences of that. So Genesis chapter 18 functions in a couple of ways. First, it goes back to the theme of the promised son. And we have the Lord visiting, along with two angels, the Lord and two angels visit Abraham and Sarah. And this prediction is made that a year from now, you'll have a son. Now, if you put this in the context, it has been 24 years since they left Haran and have come to Palestine. So for 24 years, the Lord keeps telling them, hey, you're going to have a son, you're going to have a son. Finally, they tell him, next year, you'll have a son. So this is quite an advance in the story itself. And then again, it goes back and kind of finishes up the story of Lot, which had begun several chapters earlier. So a couple of different functions of this chapter. Now, we're told in the opening verses, and the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. He being Abraham, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing in front of him. Now, we find out as we read the story, one of the men, kind of put that in quotations, is the Lord himself in some physical manifestation. And then we find out there's a couple of angels that are traveling with him as well. But they appear in a physical form. They look like men. They look like just travelers to Abraham. And it seems pretty clear that at least initially he doesn't recognize who they are. As the chapter progresses, he figures it out. But nonetheless, he lifts up his eyes and looked. Three men were standing in front of him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, O Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree while I bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on since you have come to your servant. Abraham just thinks that this is three travelers who have come his way. So how does Abraham react? That's the first thing I want you to pay attention to. Again, these three men appear. It's the Lord, we're told in verse 1. We're also told down in verse 17 that the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? And then he turns and speaks to him. And then in verse 22, the men turn from there, go toward Sodom. Abraham still stood before the Lord, and this conversation goes on where there's a recognition of who this is. The other two, as we said, are angels, and again, that becomes clearer in verse 22. The men turned from there and went toward Sodom. That's the two men who are with him. And then at the beginning of chapter 19, verse 1, instead of referring to them as men, it says the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate. So the Lord and these two angelic visitors. Now, we're told in verse 2, he looks up, he sees them with his eyes, and when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth. When our doorbell rings, I usually assume it's a salesperson. And when I think it's a salesperson, I do not run to my door. That's kind of the culture that we have today. Our home is our castle. Our home is our refuge. Our home is this place where we are safe and secure, and mostly left alone is what we kind of prefer with our houses. Now, I understand there is some Middle Eastern, Near Eastern culture here, and hospitality was over the top, even for pagans. I mean, this was not just a Jewish thing. This was even just your average, everyday Near Easterner treated strangers. So he runs to the door of his tent to meet them. He bowed himself to the earth, and he welcomes them very generously, very heartily. He said, O Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Please come in. Please stay with us. Please take food and refreshment. He says in verse 4, let a little water be brought, and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree, while I bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves. I'm going to give you a small cup of water, a Dixie cup, and a few smidgens of cracker crumbs. That's what it sounds like. But we're going to find out in a moment that has nothing to do with the hospitality that Abraham extended. It was lavish. But he's very modest in his claims, very generous in his offer. He welcomes them warmly and kindly. Now again, they appear to be just humans, as nearly as we can tell, and they're, by that account, they appear to be total strangers, but nonetheless, he welcomes them. As I said, many of us probably wouldn't even answer the door. And I understand that. Again, we like a nice refuge in our home. We not like a little bit of privacy, and we tend to be suspicious of others often. But right away, just his reaction to these strangers, I think, is instructive. It's challenging. It makes me realize sometimes we need to be a whole lot more friendly toward people. Now, I realize that the essence of hospitality isn't just friendliness. Hospitality is a lot more than that. It's a lot more specific in its content. But sometimes maybe the first thing we need to do is have a better attitude toward the people that we encounter on a day-to-day basis. I know the workplace can be difficult. And I know particularly if you work in a job where you're surrounded by people constantly. I'm the only one in my office, and I get tired of me after about 2 hours. So I can imagine what it would be like in a job where you are surrounded by people constantly, where you have customers or patients or clients in front of you from the moment you get in the office until the moment that you leave. And I know that for stay-at-home parents, stay-at-home moms, you're surrounded by your kids all day long. Sometimes that can get tiresome. And what our tendency is just leave me alone. Our tendency is, I don't want to talk to nobody about nothing. And there is a time and a place to withdraw. There is. We're told that Jesus in his ministry frequently just drew himself and his apostles away from the crowds. Sometimes Jesus went off by himself. But if we want to be good at hospitality, we have to start with a mentality that we love people. Despite their flaws, despite their annoyances, despite the fact that sometimes people are a bit inconvenient, we need to love them and be genuinely interested in their welfare. And that's one of the things I see in Abraham in this text. Second thing I notice is how Sarah didn't react. Now, my dad was famous for when we had gospel meetings or sometimes visitors at church, he was famous for just inviting them over and telling mom on the way home. Now, sometimes that didn't fly. And now mom was a very gracious host. She always liked to entertain. She tended to be kind of lavish in the way that she did things. But she kind of preferred a heads up notice from dad. Well, what I don't see, I want you to notice here in this text, verse 6, Abraham went quickly into the tent to Sarah and said, quick, 3 seahs of fine flour, knead it and make cakes. Abraham ran to the herd. Now, Sarah is still on the scene because later when the Lord is talking to Abraham, he makes this prediction of him having a son. I don't know exactly at what point when Abraham realized that this was the Lord speaking. Maybe it is here in verse 9. Where is Sarah, your wife? He said, she's in the tent. And if you'll notice at the end of verse 10, Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. So she is still kind of there while all of this is going on. And what she doesn't say is, Abraham, you idiot. What are you doing? You didn't ask me if we could have company. We don't have a thing in the cupboard. There is dust an inch thick. Now remember, they lived in the desert, so maybe that had a little bit to do with it. There's dust an inch thick on everything. Ishmael has been a terror today. The servants have not done anything. Half of them are sick. Half of them showed up late. What is wrong with you? And we don't read a word about that. What we read is, he comes in and says, quick, we got to do this. And from what we can tell, she complied wholeheartedly. Again, sometimes we just need to be a little bit more gracious about our approach to hospitality, a friendliness, a warmth about how we treat others. It starts with that. It doesn't end with that. But I think it certainly starts with that. Now, what I really want you to pay attention to here is the provisions in this chapter. Now, go back to his offer in verse 4. Let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree while I bring a morsel of bread. As I'm thinking, you know, Dixie cup and a few crumbs of bread or crackers. No. He runs in verse 6. He went quickly into the tent to Sarah and said, quick, 3 seahs of fine flour, knead it, and make cakes. Now, the New American Standard says, quick, 3 measures of flour. I'm thinking 3 cups. No. A seah was a large amount. A seah was, there are 3 measures of flour. This is about 5 gallons of flour. Now, I've never looked up the scientific basis of this, but that's a whole lot of biscuits. That's a whole lot of flatbread or something. I don't know how many biscuits 5 gallons of flour will make, but that's a bunch. That's a lot. So he's not, you know, that little morsel of bread, that's the understatement of the century. He's thinking, we're going to be generous. Now, I know Abraham had a whole lot of folks in his house. You go back to chapter 14 of Genesis. He had over 300 servants that he took into battle with him when he rescued Lot. And that's just the servants that were fighting age. Who knows how many parents and siblings and wives and children there were. So obviously they kept a lot of this stuff on hand. Leah and I were just remarking the other day, we noticed after Hannah left home, the grocery bill shrank. After Nate left home, it really shrank, although Hannah could give Nate a good run for his money. But we just noticed we just don't buy as many groceries as we used to, and we don't have as much stuff in the refrigerator as we used to. We can buy junk food now. It's in the budget. We can buy the good stuff. We can buy the brand stuff now. And we do a whole lot of eating out, but obviously there were a lot of provisions on hand for such a huge household. And don't overlook that little measure, that 3 seahs of flour. That's a lot of dough. That's a lot of bread. That's a lot of flour to keep on hand. And then I want you to notice also, after he tells Sarah to, you know, quickly take 5 gallons of flour, knead it, and make cakes. I don't know a thing about biscuit making, but I don't think you do that quickly. That would take a while. That takes some help. That takes some provisions for them to do this. So this is not like, okay, company's over, Cloyce, run down to the pizza place, buy some $5 Little Caesars and bring them home. No, this is elaborate. This takes some preparation, takes some time to do all this. And then, you keep reading, Abraham ran to the herd, took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to a young man who prepared it quickly. And again, the quickly, no way. I am not an expert on slaughtering defenseless animals. And I'm even less of an expert of preparing it for a meal. Where it says that he quickly ran to the flock, I would quickly run to Kroger's, buy a package of bologna, because that's a whole lot quicker. That's a whole lot quicker. And all of this just underlines the fact this is lavish preparation. It was not too good for him to go and take one of the best animals out of his flock. He didn't dispatch anybody. He personally picked them. He personally picked somebody to go, or he personally picked the animal himself. Then he takes it to a young man and has him prepare it. I don't know how much time passed before all of this was done, but you look at verse 8, here's another indication of the amount of time. He took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared. So he's got milk, he has curds, which is kind of like cottage cheese. And he set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. I don't know how much time passes between verse 1 of the chapter and verse 8. But these are lavish, generous, thoughtful, big preparations. And that's what I see in Abraham's reaction to these people who have come his way. Now, I realize culture changes. He couldn't go to Kroger's and get bologna and bread. Okay, I'll grant you that. And obviously, we have that kind of thing. We can take people out to eat. There's all kinds of options we have they probably didn't have. And they were used to preparing everything from scratch. We have the luxury of not having to do that. And so there are some significant cultural differences. But what really impresses me about this example of Abraham in Genesis 18, his friendliness, his outgoing, his readiness to receive someone and just make them feel at home. Make them feel at home. Be generous as he possibly could be. Abraham was a wealthy man, and so he was capable of a lot. But he wanted these guests to feel special. And I think at the root of hospitality is this love and interest that we have toward our fellow man and toward our fellow Christian. This desire that we have that when we have the opportunity to do it, we may not always have equal opportunities, but when we have the opportunity, we do our best to make others feel at home and share in our provisions with them. Now, you look at some New Testament passages about hospitality and how we are supposed to exercise it. I want to start out by suggesting that our hospitality should be an expression of our concern for others. Turn over to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, we're told in the opening verse that this happens. There's two things you need to remember. Number one, on the Sabbath. And number two, he is eating at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees. And there's a crowd gathered there. So the opening 24 verses of this chapter, everything in this in the first 24 verses revolves around the idea that this is a feast, that this is a meal at a Pharisee's house. And so he actually has quite a few things to say about the idea of hospitality. So while he is there, he heals a man. There's some rebuke or scorn about that and upset some people in the first six verses. Then in verse 7, he rebuked some of the guests. He told a parable to those who were invited when he noticed how they chose the places of honor, saying to them, "When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, 'Give your place to this person,' and then you will begin with shame to take the lowest seat. But when you're invited, go and sit in the lowest place," and so forth. So first of all, he addresses the people who are there because they're climbing all over each other trying to get the best seat in the house. So it's actually a rebuke to the other guests. And then he turns in verse 12, he also said to the man who invited him. Now, Jesus is breaking with convention. How often do you go to somebody's house and just start criticizing them? "Well, I don't like that color. I don't like this meal. I don't like where you're sitting. I don't like where you sat me. And you need to do a better job of inviting other people." You just don't criticize people like that. Jesus did. He criticized the guests for their pretentious attitude, their haughtiness, their arrogance. And he turns in verse 12 and criticizes the man who invited him. He said to the man who had invited him, "When you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you'll be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the just." So as he looks to the guest, he says, "Look, I know you've invited your friends over, and that's fine, but you need to do a better job of inviting people that need you. They need a meal. They don't have a place to eat. They don't have the resources that you do." And that's one of the consistent themes, I think, that we see about hospitality in the New Testament. It's the idea that we're trying to share with others who don't have the resources that we do. And so he criticizes this man. I suspect this ruler of the Pharisees was a wealthy man. There appeared to be quite a few people there. And I suspect that everyone was probably one of his best friends. And Jesus said, "You can do a better job. You need to look for people on the fringe. You need to look for people who don't have the friendship network that you have. You need to find people that are a little bit lonely, a little bit outcast, a little bit needy, and try to meet their needs as well." Over in Matthew chapter 25, I think this is one of the points that Jesus is making there. Matthew 25 has three parables of judgment. Three parables of judgment as he contemplates the end of things. In Matthew chapter 25, the last one is the parable of the sheep and the goats, where at the judgment day, the Lord divides all of humanity into one or two groups. And I want you to notice what he commends or condemns them for. In Matthew 25, that scene of final judgment starts in verse 31. In verse 34, the king will say to those on his right, those who meet with eternal divine approval, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." And the righteous answer and say, "Lord, when did we see you in this condition?" And his point, and then he makes the point, verse 40, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, you did it to me." And then to those on the left, he repeats almost the same words, except that "you didn't do that." A lot of what the Bible teaches about hospitality goes back to this thing: when I see someone and I have the opportunity to help them, what do I do? Now again, all of our opportunities and resources differ from person to person, from household to household. And yes, the Lord takes that into account. But we have to have a ready, willing disposition toward those who have need. Hospitality presents itself as an opportunity to express our concern for those who don't have the things that we do. How can I help this person? How can I supply a need that this person has? What can I do to meet that need? Secondly, it is an expression of our devotion to one another. Turn in your Bibles to Romans. Romans chapter 12, one of the truly great chapters in the New Testament. You've probably noticed that as we've gone through this series on good works, I've come back to Romans 12 constantly. It's such a great starting point with the idea of good works. It's full of good works. And there are so many things that we've touched on in this series that I can find references to in Romans 12. But starting in verse 9, he says, "Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer, contribute to the needs of the saints, and seek to show hospitality." Here again is that word. The word hospitality originally meant simply affection towards strangers or love of strangers. But obviously by the time we get to the New Testament era, there's a few places where it probably is referring to how we treat people that we don't know. But here in the context of Romans 12, he's talking about how we deal with Christians, our fellow Christians, and probably implies that these are people that we do know. And in the context here in verse 9, he starts out by talking about love. Let love be genuine, especially in verse 10, love one another with brotherly affection. How do you do that? And the next few phrases tell us. We do our dead level best to treat others with respect and dignity. He says, try to outdo one another in showing honor. It's almost like treating one another with love becomes a contest. It isn't. But we try to outdo one another in the way that we express our love to one another. So it's an act of devotion. And I want you to notice again in verse 13 that there's that connection between hospitality and meeting the needs of others. There's nothing wrong with inviting your friends over. Just don't forget the people that you may not be that close to. And so he says, contribute to the needs of saints and seek to show hospitality. Now, I mentioned earlier when we were talking about Abraham that I think hospitality starts with just a friendliness and a love and a genuine concern that we have for others. But it goes beyond that to the more specific connotation of sharing my possessions, sharing my food, sharing my home, sharing with things that I have with others who may not have it. More often than not, it's in the context of having people into your home. Sometimes it involves, as we saw in Matthew 25, maybe going to where they are at. But it's more than just being nice. I remember one time I was teaching a class, and the subject of hospitality came up. And one fellow, and I understood what he was saying, but I didn't agree with it. He said, "Well, I think hospitality is just being nice to people." No, it's a lot more specific than that. It is demonstrating our niceness to people, our love for people, by doing concrete acts of sharing and including them in our circle of acquaintances, our circle of fellowship, sharing things with others as we have the opportunity. It's an act of devotion as well. It's also an expression of cheerfulness on behalf of others. Over in Hebrews chapter, actually 1 Peter chapter 4, 1 Peter 4, down in verse 7, the end of all things is at hand. Therefore, and so this, the end is near. You know that the Lord is going to return at some point. What should you be doing? And here's his list. Therefore, be self-controlled, be sober-minded for the sake of your prayers. Above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. How do you do that? How about this, verse 9? Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. Have you ever been guilty about grumbling about having somebody over? Well, I guess it's our turn. They've had us over two or three times, and, well, we haven't had them over at all, so I guess we have to do this. Have to do this. Take your highlighter and circle that. Or it just seems like we're always having them over. When are they ever going to get back to us? Does that sound like the grumbling maybe that Peter is talking about? And I think sometimes you do good works. You do a lot of them. And it can get tiring. Why do you think Paul in Galatians chapter 6 warned against growing weary in doing good? Look, doing good wears you out. Good works will make you tired. And hospitality is one of those things, it'll make you tired, it'll wear you out, especially if you practice a lot of it. So there can be a tendency, and I think Peter is addressing this. We do the work of hospitality, it's an important work to do, but sometimes we can be guilty of grumbling about it, getting a little bit put out about it. So we have to watch that and make sure we're exercising a godly attitude. Also in the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 13. Here again, some applications from this wonderful book. Hebrews chapter 13, at the beginning of the chapter, let brotherly love continue. Have you noticed how many of these passages in the New Testament connect love with hospitality? Again, go back to that first 2 points. It's an expression of our concern and our devotion to one another. So Hebrews 13, let brotherly love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. And notice again in verse 3, remember those who are in prison. That's that connection back with Matthew chapter 25 and some other places. We think about the needs of others, and we do everything we can to try to meet those needs as well. So it's an expression of cheerfulness. We try to enjoy it. We try to love doing this because we love people the same way the Lord does. We're trying to do what the Lord bids us to, and we take delight in that. It's a hard thing as Christians sometimes to go from the duty that we have to delighting in that duty. So often we view God's commands as burdensome. Well, here's another thing I have to do. And what these passages speak of is transforming our thinking about these duties and viewing them less as matters of duty and more as matters of delight. I want to do this. I desire to do this. I enjoy doing this. Sometimes it is an acquired taste, yes, but it's something we can learn to do by the power of God. And then it's also an expression of our priorities. That passage we just read in 1 Peter chapter 4 started in verse 7 with a declaration that the end of all things is near. I preached on that passage a few weeks ago, and I posed that question. If you knew that the end of the world was coming, what would you do? Peter's answer, at least part of it, is be hospitable. Some people think, well, the end of the world is near, the end of my life is near. I want to go do my bucket list. I want to get away from civilization and do all the things I've always wanted to do. And Peter's answer is, if you know the end of the world is coming, you need to think about others. Wait, shouldn't we be doing that anyway? Yeah, we should. But it's an expression then of our priorities. And I think that's one reason why this word hospitality shows up in a couple of other interesting places. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, it's a qualification of an overseer. That's how important hospitality is. In 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in Titus chapter 1, it's listed as a qualification for someone who wants to be an elder. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, therefore, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent, and so forth. Some translations say given to hospitality, someone who practices this on a regular basis. That's how important this is, that when it comes time to select godly men to serve as shepherds of the flock, that's one of the things that we need to be able to look for. Is this man given to hospitality? Is it something that is important to him, and does he manifest that in the same way? So that's what our hospitality is supposed to look like. Just some practical ideas. First of all, in terms of thinking about, well, so who do I have over? And again, this lesson is not a complaint about the hospitality of this congregation. I think you do an exceptionally good job. But as in any congregation, some of us could do better. There are some who are always a little bit reluctant to really stick their necks out and do much of anything. So here's some ideas. Number one, anyone is a good person to invite over. Married couples, single adults, kids, teens, elderly, work groups. I love the work groups here. Groups 1, 2, and 3, you do a great job. They're well organized. They frequently do this kind of thing. And you use them to function in terms of hospitality. That's a great idea. Get acquainted. Use hospitality as a way of talking to someone, inviting someone into your home, inviting someone to one of the group things that you've never met before. Maybe it's someone traveling through and they're a visitor. Say, look, can you come over and eat with us tonight? I know we've done that several times here. That's the kind of thing we need to do. Anyone is a good target for your hospitality, but especially the people that we don't know well, especially people who may be on the fringes of the congregation, don't have a lot of close ties, may not have much in the way of family or friends. Look for those people and try to do your best to exercise the opportunity. Anything, there's all kinds of things you can do to practice hospitality. Start with holidays. Those are great times to have people over. Popcorn in a movie. I used to say popcorn in a VCR. I don't do that anymore. I used to even say DVDs, but that is so primitive. That's so 2000. Anyway, stream it, whatever. Popcorn in a movie. Have people over for a singing and throw in some food. Have people over for a meal. Now, I put Wii Tournament. I don't know what the current standard of video game-ology is. You know, I'm always 10, 20 years behind. That's the machine we own. I'm sure that's primitive by any modern standard. But anyway, whatever you got, have a tournament in your house. Games and sports, and I mean all kinds of games, all kinds of sports. Some people like putting puzzles together. Some people are crazy about board games. Some people are nuts about card games. Whatever you like, have somebody over and have some games or sports. Have people over just for desserts. Who needs the meal when you got dessert? I mean, really? Eat out. Take somebody out on your nickel. That's a kind of hospitality. Have a potluck. Have a picnic. Have one of the groups, I don't remember who, had the most blessed event this summer in an ice cream gathering one Sunday night. That was inspirational. But all kinds of things you can do. Don't limit your imagination. Now, try this. Now, again, I know we have people here who constantly exercise this, so I'm not really talking to you. I'm talking to the people who aren't comfortable doing this, to the people who think, you know, I need to do better, I just don't know what to do. Try this. Number one, set a goal. About every 3 to 4 months. Don't think that I'm going to set a goal. I'm going to have somebody over to my house every week. Ain't going to happen, especially if you haven't been doing it for a while. Just start simple. About every 3 or 4 months, say, okay, I'm going to get together with some fellow Christians. Number two, join efforts. Say, go talk to somebody that you know and say, you know what, I want to do this. Can I get your help? Or maybe you're already doing some hospitality and you know someone who may not be able to do it much. Ask for their help. Say, I'm organizing this get together. Can you come help me with this? That's a great way to include others. Start small. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. It doesn't have to be a whole lot of people. Just start. And then include maybe some people you don't know well. And again, just who haven't I not been able to visit? You know, this church is great about staying after services and talking to people, but as good as we are, sometimes you still miss people. I try to talk to as many people as I can. I stand back at the back door. That is putting your life at risk with the mad rush out at the end of the services. And I still miss people. I will see people as I'm up here preaching. I'll see people after church. I say, I'm going to go talk to them, and by the time I get to where they were, they've gone. And that's just one of the job hazards of being a Christian. So take some of those people you don't get to visit with very often, or you don't see on a social basis very often, and try to include them. Do something different than maybe the last time you did it. Maybe you need to change things up for variety's sake. There's a lot of things you can do. Karen Maines is an author. I really don't know much about her, but she suggests a difference between entertaining and true hospitality. She says that one seeks to impress, the other seeks to serve. Entertainment says, I want to impress you with my home, my decorating, my cooking. Hospitality says, this home is my gift from my master. I use it as he desires. Entertainment puts things before people. As soon as I get the house finished, the living room decorated, my house cleaning done, then I'll start inviting people. Hospitality puts people first. No furniture? We'll eat on the floor. The decorating may never get done. Come anyway. The house is a mess, but your friends come home with us anyway. Entertaining declares, this home is mine, an expression of my personality. Look, please, and admire. Hospitality says, what is mine is yours. And I think that's really the essence of what this is about. We are challenged by the Lord. We're commanded by the Lord. We were redeemed by the Lord for the purpose of doing good works. And we've spent all year talking about all kinds of good works, and this one is an important one. It's something we need to practice, something most of us could probably do a little bit better at, and so we need to take it to heart and try to do the things that we can as opportunities present themselves. If you're here this morning and you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord, you have the opportunity, as we close this session this morning, you have the opportunity to obey Jesus as Lord, to become a follower of his, by coming down to the front, confessing your faith in Jesus Christ, and by being buried with him in baptism. For those of us that are Christians, we always need to inspect ourselves, self-examination, look at our lives, and make sure we're doing the kinds of things that the Lord wants us to do. Whatever your need is, we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.